lately.
Yes.
Shelves are empty. Gas prices are doubled. Inflation's at 31-year high. I mean, what a joke. You know, I know you don't like Trump. Okay, that's good. You don't like the way he tweeted, or you don't like what he said about bleach. I mean, really, grow up, be an adult. He had his foot on Putin's neck.
Okay. So there's, I think, 11. I'd have to go back. I think there were 11 lies there. Now, you know, I mean, I've already spoken about gas prices, and it's a real problem. It's a problem in a number of ways. It just doesn't really have to do with Joe Biden.
In North Korea under his thumb. What a joke, really. You need to wake up. You and all your listeners need to wake up, and you need to stop passing that propaganda, that Democratic propaganda you pass off as reality.
I'm not even a Democrat.
Yeah, we think Trump won. Well, or at least he would have won if there wasn't a pandemic and you didn't bend those rules in your favor so you could drop off ballots, have carloads of people pulling up, you know, have people mailing in millions and millions of ballots.
I think we're up to, is it 18 lies so far? We're only 51 seconds in, but 18 lies.
Yeah, Trump would have won if you didn't cheat. And that's cheating. I don't know what you think cheating is. There has to be some grand conspiracy. The grand conspiracy is Democrats change the rules.
Yeah. Remember, even Republican legislatures also modified voting rules to allow people to vote by mail who wouldn't ordinarily be allowed to. It doesn't really matter. But again, this is a reminder. There's people we can talk to reasonably, and there's people we can't. That guy seems to be beyond saving. We've got a great bonus show for you today. We will actually talk about the Joe Biden approval rating bump that happened. Is it Ukraine? Is it the State of the Union? What is it? We will talk about U.S. Olympic champion Brittany Griner being arrested and held in Russia. And we will talk about a man sentenced to prison for using the COVID loan money that he got to buy Pokemon cards. All of those stories and more on today's bonus show. I have some COVID money fraud stories to tell myself. Not of anything I did, but just of things I've caught wind of. Sign up at joinpacman.com. Get instant.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT AC Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
WRCT in sound from way out.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Today, I'm announcing the United States is targeting the main artery of Russia's economy. We're banning all imports of Russian oil and gas and energy.
The United States has banned Russian energy imports as Russia's invasion of Ukraine enters its 14th day. We'll speak to Antonia Yuhas, author of The Tyranny of Oil, about the ban and growing calls for a green energy revolution. Then we speak to Tariq Ali in London about Russia's invasion, NATO's expansion in Eastern Europe, and Ukrainian President Zelensky's historic address to the House of Commons.
We will not give up and we will not lose. We will fight till the end. We will fight at sea. We will fight in the air. We will defend our land, whatever the cost. We will fight in the forests, in the fields, on the shores, in the cities and villages.
Plus, the Florida State Senate has passed the so-called Don't Say Gay education bill, while welfare officials in Texas have been ordered to launch child abuse investigations against parents who seek gender-affirming care for their transgender children. We'll talk to the ACLU's Chase Strangio.
Fighting back against both these measures, pushing Governor DeSantis to veto the so-called Don't Say Gay bill, and continuing to press forward with our litigation in Texas. These are happening amidst a national effort to attack transgender children. We are also seeing bills that would criminalize health care for transgender minors moving forward in Alabama and Idaho.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Russia's assault on Ukraine continues 2 weeks after it launched its invasion. Hundreds of civilians have been killed. Over 2 million people have become refugees as thousands more attempt to flee Ukraine's cities amidst the Russian onslaught. Residents in besieged areas are running out of medicine, food, water. Hundreds of thousands have lost power. The International Committee of the Red Cross called the humanitarian situation apocalyptic. Ukraine says it will attempt to evacuate civilians through six humanitarian corridors after Russia pledged to observe local ceasefires, though previous efforts have failed. On Tuesday, 5,000 people were evacuated from the city of Sumy, including around 700 Indian students who'd been trapped since the start of the war and many other students of color from around the world. The Pentagon rejected an offer by Poland to send its fleet of MiG-29 fighter jets to Ukraine using a U.S. airbase in Germany, saying it, quote, raises serious concerns for the entire NATO alliance. This comes as Vice President Kamala Harris embarks on a two-day visit to Poland today and Romania. Meanwhile, efforts are ramping up to further isolate Russia. On Tuesday, President Biden announced the U.S. is banning Russian oil.
Russian oil will no longer be acceptable at U.S. ports, and the American people will deal another powerful blow to Putin's war machine. This is a move that has strong bipartisan support in Congress and, I believe, in the country. Americans have rallied to support the Ukrainian people and made it clear we will not be part of subsidizing Putin's war.
In response, Kremlin accused the U.S. of declaring an economic war on Russia. The U.S. imports 3% of its crude oil from Russia. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced the U.K. will phase out Russian oil imports by the end of the year. Meanwhile, the European Union outlined plans to cut Russian gas imports by two-thirds this year and end dependency on Russian fossil fuels, quote, well before 2030. McDonald's, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and Starbucks have temporarily stopped doing business in Russia. Ukraine's state-run nuclear company is warning of a radioactive leak risk after losing power at the Russian-occupied Chernobyl nuclear plant. Meanwhile, a Moldovan oil tanker appears to still be burning in the Black Sea nearly 2 weeks after it was reportedly hit by a Russian military strike. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky became the first foreign head of state to virtually address the British Parliament Tuesday, where he told lawmakers over 50 children have been killed since the start of the Russian invasion. The UN said 1 million children have become refugees at a pediatric hospital in Kharkiv. Doctors report treating children with critical injuries.
We have operated on four children suffering from shrapnel wounds or bullet wounds. Sadly, one little girl died yesterday. She was admitted on the first night of the aggression and invasion of our country. Yesterday, another little boy was admitted. The boy was inside a multi-story residential block, which was hit by a missile.
Venezuela's released two jailed U.S. citizens following a rare visit to Caracas by a delegation from Washington, D.C. One of the freed prisoners is Gustavo Cardenas, a Citgo oil executive who was arrested in 2017 and convicted of corruption, a charge rejected by the U.S. The other is Cuban-American Jorge Alberto Fernandez, reportedly accused of terrorism for flying a drone. The White House said talks about releasing American prisoners were not related to a possible easing of sanctions on Venezuela amidst the Russian oil ban. In Guatemala, a massive data leak has revealed the multinational mining giant Solway Group bribed local police and other officials to repress indigenous resistance to its destructive open-pit nickel mine in the town of El Estor in the eastern Izabal region. Leaked documents show Solway, which is based in Switzerland, hid evidence of environmental destruction in the region, including the pollution of a sacred lake, spied on journalists who investigated the mine, and intimidated and bribed local community leaders. The report was published by Forbidden Stories and was led by 65 journalists around the world. A Washington, D.C. jury found Guy Wesley Reffitt, the first Capitol insurrection defendant to go on trial, guilty on all five charges he faced. Reffitt, who's aligned with the far-right militia, the Three Percenters, led the pro-Trump mob that breached the Capitol building as Congress was certifying the 2020 election. He also threatened his children so they wouldn't turn him in to authorities. His 19-year-old son, Jackson Reffitt, nonetheless shared information with the FBI about his father's participation in the attack and testified against him during the trial. Guy Reffitt now faces 20 years in prison for obstruction of justice and obstruction of Congress. In related news, a federal grand jury Tuesday indicted Enrique Tarrio, leader of the far-right Proud Boys, with conspiracy to obstruct Congress on January 6th. Tarrio was not at the Capitol insurrection, having been arrested 2 days earlier for vandalism at a black church. But prosecutors say he was fully involved in the planning of the attack and was in touch with other Proud Boys during the assault. The Florida State Senate passed the anti-LGBTQ education bill known as the Don't Say Gay Bill Tuesday, despite stark opposition from Democrats, rights advocates, and many students and educators. The bill, which would ban discussions of sexuality and gender identity in schools, now heads to the desk of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who's voiced support for the measure. On Tuesday, State Senator Chevron Jones, Florida's first openly gay member of the Senate, made an emotional plea to his colleagues during debate.
And to those who think you can legislate gay people away, I'm sorry. You cannot. I think you should spend your time legislating to protect them. So to those children who were out there yesterday, and to every person who have been rejected by anyone, We love you. Thank you for showing up every single day as your true, authentic self. Keep going.
The Idaho State House has passed a bill that would criminalize gender-affirming health care for transgender children and teens, joining several other U.S. states that have enacted or introduced similar bills. The bill makes it a felony punishable with life in prison for a doctor to provide the medically necessary care, which includes surgeries and hormone treatments. It would also make it a felony to take trans youth out of the state to receive the life-saving care elsewhere. The bill now heads to the Idaho State Senate for consideration. We'll talk more about this later in the broadcast with the ACLU's Chase Strangio. In Minnesota, around 3,500 Minneapolis public school teachers and education support staff are on strike, demanding better conditions for students and fair wages. Demands include reduced class sizes, ensuring all schools have a counselor and social worker, and a more diverse staff. It's the first teacher strike in Minneapolis in over half a century. This is Greta Hallahan of the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers speaking Monday as the union announced the strike.
We continue to say our students need and deserve more, and we continue to be shut out of the decision-making process. Those of us on the ground floor are here to say that our kids deserve better. And when you have thousands of people saying we will go without pay so that our kids can have the schools they deserve, you know that something is wrong in the Minneapolis public schools.
A bipartisan Senate passed a major $107 billion overhaul of the U.S. Postal Service Tuesday. The Postal Service Reform Act eliminates a costly 2006 mandate that required the U.S. Post Office to fund employee retirement benefits 75 years in advance and instead directs retired workers to enroll in Medicare. The plan also ensures delivery 6 days a week, orders the creation of an online delivery dashboard, and strengthens financial reporting requirements to Congress. The measure, which cleared the House with overwhelming support last month, now heads to President Biden's desk for signing. Meanwhile, a House bill is expected to be introduced today that would require a contract for a new fleet of delivery trucks to be made up of at least 75% electric vehicles. Here in New York City, immigrant workers left out of government pandemic relief took to the streets Tuesday, International Women's Day, shutting down traffic on the Manhattan and Brooklyn bridges. Workers and advocates are demanding $3 billion be added to the Excluded Workers Fund and the creation of a permanent unemployment insurance program. This is Ana Maria Archila, longtime activist, now running for lieutenant governor of New York.
Governor Hochul had an opportunity to include the Excluded Workers Fund in her budget, and she chose not to. Governor Hochul had an opportunity to make sure that immigrant families would not be excluded from healthcare, and she chose not to. And that's why we are on the streets, because she is choosing to prioritize the needs and the priorities and the interests of billionaires in a moment when immigrant workers have been at the forefront of protecting every single one of us.
And elsewhere on International Women's Day, Russian police arrested women who led an anti-war protest. Meanwhile, Ukrainian women in Kyiv spent the day in bomb shelters. In Turkey, at least 38 women were detained in Istanbul as riot police set up barricades and fired pepper gas at protesters. In Sudan, security forces fired tear gas at a women's rights rally. This is one of the protesters.
In spite of all the violations that happened to me, and so it doesn't happen to others, there are women who have been humiliated, who have been raped, so this will not happen to others because we reject all these violations. And in spite of all these violations, these things will not prevent us from revolting. We will go on, in spite of the repression and persecution of women. They will not scare us with all this. We will continue our revolution and will not fear a thing.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, as Russia's invasion of Ukraine enters its 14th day, we begin today's show looking at the war's impact on global energy markets. On Tuesday, President Biden announced a ban on imports of Russian oil, gas, and coal. Britain followed up by saying it would phase out imports of Russian oil by the end of the war. The European Union has announced plans to reduce its dependence on Russian oil and gas by two-thirds this year. President Biden announced the U.S. ban during an address from the White House.
Today, I'm announcing the United States is targeting the main artery of Russia's economy. We're banning all imports of Russian oil and gas and energy. That means Russian oil will no longer be acceptable at U.S. ports, and the American people will deal another powerful blow to Putin's war machine. This is a move that has strong bipartisan support in Congress and, I believe, in the country. Americans have rallied to support the Ukrainian people and made it clear we will not be part of subsidizing Putin's war.
Britain said it would end Russian oil imports by the end of the year. Global oil and gas prices have soared over the past 2 weeks since Russia invaded Ukraine, and experts warn prices could keep rising. Earlier this week, Russia threatened to cut off natural gas shipments to Europe in response to Western sanctions. Russia provides the EU countries with about 40% of their natural gas and about a quarter of its oil. Meanwhile, oil giants BP, Shell, and Exxon have announced plans to halt its operations in Russia. The CEOs of Big Oil have long had close to the Russian government. Former Exxon CEO Rex Tillerson, who served as Secretary of State under Donald Trump, received Russia's Order of Friendship Medal by Vladimir Putin in 2013. On Tuesday, analyst at Goldman Sachs said, quote, given Russia's key role in global energy supply, the global economy could soon be faced with one of the largest energy supply shocks ever. In recent days, the Biden administration's begun exploring other ways to increase global oil supply. Over the weekend, Biden administration officials traveled to Venezuela to discuss the possible lifting of sanctions on the nation's oil industry. The White House has also floated the idea of Biden visiting Saudi Arabia in an effort to mend relations and to urge the kingdom to pump more oil. While the Biden administration's pushing more oil drilling, many climate activists say now is the time to invest in a green energy revolution. Democratic Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts said, quote, this moment is a clarion call for the urgent need to transition to domestic clean energy so that we're never again complicit in fossil-fueled conflict. We go now to Antonio Yuhas, investigative journalist focused on energy and climate. Antonio is the author of three books, including The Tyranny of Oil. She teaches at Tulane University in New Orleans, where she is joining us from. Antonio, welcome back to Democracy Now! Let's begin with President Biden's unilateral announcement of energy ban, oil, gas and coal from Russia. The significance of this.
It's extremely significant, Amy, and thank you so much for having me, and thank you, Juan. I think what there is many parts of that speech that were very important. I would say the most important is actually when Biden said the U.S. must transition to clean energy. That'll mean tyrants like Putin won't be able to use fossil fuels as weapons against other nations. He didn't limit it to Putin, and he essentially stated that the United States was going to now see the wielding of fossil fuels as a weapon of war. And that's a profound statement and should have profound impacts on the way that we look at the way many nations and many companies use fossil fuels and the impacts on people, the economy, war, peace, the climate, et cetera. By stating that the United States would end any oil, liquefied natural gas or coal imports, the United States was being the first nation to take that full step against Putin and to essentially say that peace in Ukraine is dependent on us shifting off of fossil fuels, ending Russia's ability to wield fossil fuels as a weapon of war, and the world and the nation's necessity to transition off of fossil fuels. And that's a message that has been being loudly repeated out of the political leadership in the Ukraine, citizens of Ukraine, people around the world, the head of the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres. This message has been kept being repeated that a key tool towards peace is the unwinding of the global reliance on fossil fuels.
But Antonia, at the same time, the Biden administration is looking to reorient its supplies and obviously world supplies in discussions with Venezuela, possibilities. There seems to be an impetus to reach a deal with Iran, and also the attempts to get Saudi Arabia and some of the Gulf states to increase their oil supplies. Both leaders of the Emirates and of Saudi Arabia declined to have phone calls with Biden, apparently, according to press reports. So is it really a shifting of more toward renewable energy, or is it an issue of having to reorient the supply routes in terms of oil?
Yeah, there's the short and the long term. So first of all, I think it's really important to say that the price spike that we've seen immediately in the aftermath of the Russian invasion of Ukraine is not about a shortage of supply of any natural resource at this point, of oil or natural gas. It's energy traders trading on the expectation of a reduction in supply and pushing the price of oil up. The price of oil going up has immediately impacted the price of gasoline. If we regulated energy traders' behavior, we could address that problem right now. But the reality is right now, the expectation is that there will be a reduction in supply of Russian oil on the global market, of Russian natural gas, because Putin has already been using the supply of natural gas as a tool against Europe. So controlling the flow, the decision whether to let natural gas flow to Europe, which also has very significant impacts. So in the short term, the Biden administration did orchestrate, which is a fairly profound shift in global energy politics. The International Energy Agency acted to coordinate its members, led by the United States, to increase oil supplies by 60 million barrels. That was essentially as a direct rebuff against OPEC's unwillingness to do so. And that is because Saudi Arabia is aligned with Russia and trying to protect Russian interests and is not going to put more oil into the market in order to support Russia. It is not surprising to me that the Saudis are not taking Biden's call. I don't think that's going to happen. In the short term, there is a desire to demonstrate that there will be more oil, and that should hopefully reduce the stress that's being put on the market by energy traders, and again, the expectation of a reduction in supply. But I think we need to hold the administration and the rest of global leaders to their pledges, which is that they are saying this is a short-term solution. The long-term or even immediate-term solution is the transition to fossil fuels, and they need to be held to those statements. Every member of the Biden administration who has spoken has reiterated that statement, and they need to be held to that statement, because what, if anything, this war has shown us is how insecure we are based on this dependence. The United States is the leading guzzler by far of gasoline. The power that the price of gasoline has over political elections, people's pocketbooks, everything in between, is an incredible weakness. The dependence of Europe on, and I call it methane gas, not natural gas, because natural gas is about 93% methane. Europe's dependence on methane gas has put it into this position where it is having an almost impossible time divorcing itself from Putin's power. Being unable to do that means that there isn't a stand to be able to take against wielding the war against Ukraine. So that incredible weakness that is created by that dependence on methane gas, and the idea that methane gas should be considered a quote-unquote bridge fuel from fossil fuels to renewable energy, I think has been put into stark, it has been exposed to be not a bridge fuel at all, but rather a continued weakness, not only on compounding the climate crisis, but in continuing to support autocrats and some of the most brutal regimes in the world. I think we need to look at the actions of the oil companies, BP, Shell, even Exxon, who have been unwinding and divesting their partnerships with Russia, and doing so with public statements in which they say that they are doing this for humanitarian reasons. They do not want to put their money behind Putin and support his war. And that sentiment, the same as Biden's sentiment in his speech, needs to be applied and thought of to all of their partnerships with all of the other countries that are wielding control over fossil fuels as weapons. Saudi Arabia is a key example, and its brutal war in Yemen. All of the same oil companies that partner with Russia and Putin partner with the Saudis, are in deep partnerships with the Saudis. And expanding this analysis to say, how can we unplug this power, this influence? In the short term in the United States, we need to be really clear. We have we import zero liquefied natural gas from Russia. We only get about 3% of our oil from Russia, which we don't need. And we do import some coal. But we are not reliant on any of these, on any of those resources, and we can immediately lead the globe in demonstrating that our goal isn't quote unquote energy independence. We don't need to be independent of other nations, but what we do need to do is make our energy sources localized and democratized so that we are using less energy by placing renewable energy sources as close to us as possible, making them democratically controlled, cooperatively controlled and operated so that we are not simply replacing one form of extractives, massive extractives to supply renewable energy with what we are giving away for fossil fuels. But to say that the more that we can localize our energy sources, the less dependent we are on any mass extraction or mass control of that extraction of the resource. And we can do that rapidly, and we can do that right away, and we can help other nations do that as well.
Well, Antonio, I want to follow up on this issue of Europe's position, though. Obviously, Europe did not follow directly with Biden's decision yesterday. What about the issue of this Nord Stream 1 gas pipeline, and also that this crisis erupts just as Nord Stream 2 was getting to ready to go into operation?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is a war that is the first significant, well, since Russia's invasion of Crimea, the first superpower war over fossil fuels, about fossil fuels in the climate era. And that has dramatically changed the discussion of all of these issues. So this isn't a war for oil in the way that the Iraq war was, literally to capture oil fields and turn them over to oil companies. This is a war that is fueled by the financial support of fossil fuels, that is supporting Putin and giving him control over so much of world decision making. But also, the immediate impetus for the war was a dispute over a natural gas pipeline, Nord Stream 2. So Nord Stream 1 is a pipeline that carries a significant amount of methane gas to Europe. And it goes from Russia through Ukraine, under the Black Sea, to Germany. And Putin has been withholding natural gas from that pipeline to Europe as he is trying to get Nord Stream 2 into action. And Nord Stream 2 specifically does not go through the Ukraine, bypasses the Ukraine, so that Putin wasn't exposed to this weakness of Ukraine's somewhat control of that pipeline. Bypasses Ukraine, follows a similar path to get to Germany. It's built, it's ready to go. But Europe and the United States have been trying to stop Russia's pending action against Ukraine by not letting the gas flow through Nord Stream 2. And that recent decision to not let the gas go through Nord Stream 2 was the most immediate predecessor to Putin's decision to invade Ukraine. So in many ways, this is a war that's about a pipeline, you know, the flow of natural gas, and about Putin's ability to wield fossil fuels as a weapon.
On Monday, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki had this response when asked by Fox if the U.S. would do more to produce oil at home.
Let me give you the facts here, and I know that can be inconvenient, but I think they're important in this moment. To the contrary, we have been clear that in the short term, supply must keep up with the demand. We are, and here and around the world, will we make the shift to a secure, clear, clean energy future. We are one of the largest producers with a strong domestic oil and gas industry. We have actually produced more oil. It is at record numbers, and we will continue to produce more oil. There are 9,000 approved drilling permits that are not being used.
Wow. So here is Jen Psaki saying we're going to up the production of oil at a time with the huge push for renewables. And she is admitting this. So there's an interesting challenge here. You have the Ukraine bill that's racing through Congress, around $10 billion to help Ukraine. Then there's the issue of whether there is a way of crafting Build Back Better to be framed in terms of Ukraine, which would make it more palatable to Republicans. Can you talk about this and which side is going to win, not Republican or Democrat, but those who are deeply concerned about renewables versus a huge gush of more oil production in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, Jen Psaki said about 3 days earlier that the core of the Biden administration's agenda is to transition to clean energy and off of fossil fuels as rapidly as possible. And I think actually both are true. So what I think she's doing right now is there is a huge push that was first led by the American Petroleum Institute, the largest oil company lobbying group in the United States, putting pressure, and this was now just a week and a half ago, this has all happened so quickly, on the Biden administration not to implement any sanctions on Russian oil, not because they were worried necessarily about Putin, but because of all the U.S. oil companies and Western oil companies that have such large stakes in Russia, and they didn't want those to be impacted. At the same time, the American Petroleum Institute and their, you know, supporters in Congress have been pushing that the response to the war needs to be that we produce more oil and that we can't pass Build Back Better. We can't pass legislation that would put more restrictions, more regulations on the oil industry, because obviously the solution to the war is that the United States needs to be producing so much more oil and gas. So what the response of the Biden administration has been is, don't worry, we are producing tons of oil and natural gas. The first year of an administration, and just to be clear, is usually the results of the policies of the previous administration. So the Trump administration didn't produce as much as in its first year because it was still under the sway of the Biden administration's Obama administration's policies. Trump then significantly, dramatically increased production over the course of his subsequent years in office, reaching a high point just before the COVID crash. This first year of the Biden administration is really the tail ends of Trump administration policies that have kept that production at record highs. And Jen Psaki is saying, look, we're producing all of this oil and gas, so the solution, therefore, is clearly not to reduce regulation. Our regulations are not stopping you from producing. They're trying to get, I believe that the administration is trying to get Build Back Better passed. If we want to rapidly transition to renewable, localized, democratized renewable energy in the United States, that's the bill. That's the bill that's in Congress right now to do it. And of course, as I'm sure your listeners know, it's been stopped by one senator, really, and that is Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who is the most heavily funded fossil fuel member of Congress by a long shot right now. Obviously, coal is his primary personal financial interest, but he is the most heavily supported of the fossil fuel industry of any member of Congress right now. And he is single-handedly stopping this bill from moving forward. And it's very, very hard for the administration to act on its pledges to transition to renewable energy without that legislation. That said, there are executive orders that the administration can do and can put into place. And it proved that it could do that yesterday when Biden gave his speech. He simultaneously released two executive orders that go further than the ban on the imports, but also ban U.S. companies and banks or any financiers from financing or investing in Russian energy. And the one question that brings to my mind is there are still corporate holdouts. So Chevron, for example, has not divested its holdings in the Caspian pipeline. Exxon hasn't divested its holdings in the Caspian pipeline. They're in partnership with Russian oil, with Russia on that pipeline because it carries their oil from Kazakhstan. They really want to keep producing in Kazakhstan. Talk about a world leader that is a brutal controller of his country. That's Kazakhstan, and they don't want to lose those holdings, and they don't want to lose that pipeline. So there is a lot of moving parts happening here. And the bottom line is to keep putting pressure on the administration, on the companies, to uphold their pledges, that the bottom line is to achieve first peace in Ukraine and stop Putin, and then to make the transition from fossil fuels.
Antonia Yuhas, I want to thank you for being with us. There is so much to talk about. Investigative journalist focused on energy and climate, author of several books, including The Tyranny of Oil. She's speaking to us from New Orleans, where she teaches at Tulane University. Coming up, we go to London to speak with Tariq Ali about Russia's invasion, NATO expansion in Eastern Europe, and the Ukrainian president's historic address to the House of Commons yesterday. Stay with us. Ukrainian Village Voices, a New York City-based collective of Ukrainian and non-Ukrainian singers whose mission is to preserve and revive the polyphonic singing style of Ukraine's villages. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we continue to look at Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we go to London. On Tuesday, the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, gave a historic virtual address to the British House of Commons.
We will not give up.
We will not give up and we will not lose. We will fight till the end. We will fight at sea. We will fight in the air. We will defend our land, whatever the cost. We will fight in the forests, in the fields, on the shores, in the cities and villages, on the streets. We will fight on the hills. Strengthen the sanctions against the country, terrorist Russia, and recognize it as a terrorist country. Find the way to make our Ukrainian sky safe. Do what you can, what you have to, what is obliged by the greatness of your country and your people.
Ukrainian President Zelensky received a standing ovation from the British lawmakers. Joining us now from London is historian, activist, filmmaker, author Tariq Ali. He's on the editorial committee of the New Left Review. Days before the Russian invasion, he wrote a piece headlined News from NATO Land. On Sunday, he took part in an International Day of Action against the war in Ukraine. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Tariq. Can you talk about what Zelensky's message was, what Britain is doing, and overall, your response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine?
Amy, let's start with Zelensky's message. It was, you know, a propaganda message, quite honestly, using some famous phrases from Churchill's speeches, but forgetting it wasn't Churchill's speeches that won the Second World War. It was, as the whole world knows or should know, the key battles fought by the Red Army on Russian soil and what is now Ukrainian soil that destroyed the spinal cord of Hitler's Germany and led to defeat. We should never forget that, whatever the rhetoric. The basic purpose of Zelensky's address to the House of Commons, clearly organized by the Foreign Office, etc., was to plead for a no-fly zone. That's the key demand of the Ukrainians, but it's a demand that NATO has intelligently so far rejected because it knows that to impose a no-fly zone over the Ukraine at the present time could lead to a mega escalation of the war and possibly the use of nuclear weapons. So that particular demand isn't going to get anywhere. It's largely pressure on Putin, but Putin knows what he's doing. Now, as far as the war itself is concerned, Amy, how will it end? In fact, nobody knows. Neither Putin, who launched it, nor NATO, who have created a situation over the last 30 years, as some of the more intelligent U.S. commentators have been telling us now for a long time, has finally reached its apogee. It will end here, whatever the solution. My own feeling is that Putin's attempt to mimic the United States and pretend that Russia is a great imperial power is foolhardy. It won't work. Apart from anything else, apart from the fact that he is isolated from large chunks of the countries around him, if you look at the U.S., if you look at the GDP of Russia, it's 1.4 trillion, less even than Italy, and minuscule compared to the United States, which is on 20.9 trillion. So how can you even attempt to mimic the United States, even were it a good thing, which it obviously isn't? So I think it's backfired. And I think the key question now we have to ask is the following. How should we try and end this war? Further escalation, further armaments, pouring in weapons is going to make conditions worse, principally for the people of Ukraine. They're the ones who are suffering the most. And it's the refugees and the ordinary citizens who don't want this who are suffering. And so the question has to be asked, is a bloody partition the only solution? And if it is, then why not start the process now? Neither side wants it, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't argue for it, just like we argue for ending fossil fuels. It's no more utopian than that. So it's something that nobody is arguing. In Britain, just look at it. In Russia, we've seen the emergence of a really courageous, powerful peace movement for which one has total sympathy. They're being beaten up. They're being locked up. In Britain, both Boris Johnson and his understudy, the Labour leader Keir Starmer, have attacked Stop the War. In Russia, Putin tells them you're agents of NATO, which they deny and say we don't support NATO. Here in Britain, Johnson and Starmer attack the peace movement and saying by bringing in criticisms of NATO, you're supporting Putin, which we deny as well. It was George Bush who started this whole thing. If you're not with us and our wars, you're with the terrorists. And we said it wasn't an acceptable way of arguing, and we refused to accept that divide as we're doing now. So the key thing politicians in Europe and elsewhere should be asking are, how are we going to end this tragedy? I don't think Putin, who miscalculated, I think disastrously, what he could achieve. I mean, it's obvious now from information coming out. He thought it would be a quick sortie. And they met with resistance which they weren't prepared for. I mean, to give you just one example, Putin sent policemen, you know, his police guard, people who do special duties in as security, into Kiev, who were beaten back. Quite a lot of them were killed. So it's not in anyone's interest, not in the interest, certainly not in the interests of Russia. So we could have a number of things coming out of this conflict, a bloody partition of the Ukraine, which I think is better than a continuing war. And Putin could be toppled from within Russia, because people in Russia are beginning to see exactly what is going on. And some of my more utopian friends, Russian philosophers and activists, are telling me we are hoping that he will suffer a blow at the hands of the Ukrainians, not NATO. And so it might trigger off a new revolution in Russia itself. I don't believe any of this. I think effectively the Russian elite will get very angry if this war goes on endlessly. Because how can you maintain control of a country which doesn't want to be occupied? NATO has just learned that after 20 years in Afghanistan, or I hope they have learned that, and will not attempt a repeat performance anywhere in Europe. Putin should have learned that from Russia's own experiences in Afghanistan, but he clearly hasn't. How can you occupy a country without keeping thousands and thousands and thousands of your own troops there? Even if you set up a puppet government, they will need the backing of Russian troops. So I'm sure these things are being discussed seriously. Or, Amy, you could do what the U.S. did in relation to Venezuela, having failed to topple the Chavista governments and Maduro. They actually created an imaginary government with a total imbecile, Guaido, as its president, recognized him, got their European friends to do the same. No one in South America takes it seriously. No one. So you can imagine, an imagined president in an imagined country. Putin could try the same. I wouldn't advise it. Be a total failure. And the third thing to point out, that whereas in the past, you had a situation where Ukrainians were fairly evenly divided between being not with Russia, but broadly speaking on that side, or broadly speaking, being with the United States and its military organization, NATO. It was 40-40. It was at one stage even higher, 50-50. Now we don't know. But I would suggest, speaking to some of my friends from Ukraine, that no one wants a permanent occupation by the Russians, or very few people do, and that there are probably more people now in favor of NATO than there were before.
And so, Tariq, I wanted to ask you this issue of the response of those on the left. There's an article in the New York Times today that says socialist response to the war in Ukraine has put some Democrats on edge. And it's openly critical of the democratic socialists of America for claiming that the imperialist expansionism of NATO helped to fuel the crisis that exists now. There are already candidates running against people like Jamal Bowman on a foreign policy position and attacking DSOC. What should be the response of those on the left to this invasion and the situation right now?
I think we can't dissociate the invasion completely from NATO's aggressive policies over the last few decades. I mean, they were warned that don't try it on in the Ukraine. And yet last November, Biden went ahead and said that the protocols were all ready to incorporate the Ukraine into NATO. Now, it's not just the left that is saying this. You have to understand, Thomas Friedman in the New York Times, their star columnist, cannot by any stretch of the imagination be said to be on the left. Yet his two columns in February were very critical. And he quoted a very interesting piece from George Kennan, who, you know, is the father of Cold War historiography, of the real old Cold War. And Kennan warned some years ago that if you carry on like this, you will end up with a very ugly situation in the Ukraine. Then you have other examples, that in 2008, Condoleezza Rice in Bush's White House was told clearly by an intelligence official that he had been in Russia for 2.5 years and had met nobody. He said, I met everyone, people who hated Putin, liberals, people in the military, and none of them supported NATO in the Ukraine. So he said, cleverly and intelligently, move back from that position. This man who said this, William Burns, is currently director of the Central Intelligence Agency, having to deal with the consequences of his own rejection, of advice he had given that was rejected. So saying that NATO is involved is, you know, just a fact of life. I mean, there are a number of very good books by U.S. foreign policy scholars coming up. One called Not One Inch, by Emmy Surratt at Johns Hopkins, and she argues that from the very beginning, there was the failure of Russian leaders to understand that basically the U.S. and Germany were going to go their own way. And Gorbachev was stabbed in the front. Not one inch eastwards should we move, said Baker. That was the pledge given in return for German unification. And Helmut Kohl, the West German chancellor at the time, told Gorbachev, we will not even permit NATO bases on the former East Germany. That is how far they went. Not one inch. They came in 300 miles through swathes of former Soviet Union territory. So you have to
understand. Tarek, we have 10 seconds. We have 10 seconds.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Tarek. Clearly a lot to unpack here, and we will continue this conversation. We also will post online a discussion with you about what's happening in Venezuela with Juan Gonzalez, not our own Juan Gonzalez, but the emissary for President Biden, going to meet with Maduro in Venezuela and what this means. Tarek Ali is historian, activist, filmmaker, and author on the editorial committee of New Left Review. Days before the Russian invasion, he wrote a piece headlined News from NATO Land. Coming up, Florida state senates passed the so-called Don't Say Gay bill, which aims to ban the discussion of sexuality and gender identity in schools. Students, teachers are rising up in protest. Stay with us.
There are times.
When we make it through, this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Florida Senate voted Tuesday to ban the discussion of sexuality and gender identity in schools. The legislation, known as the Don't Say Gay bill, has faced mounting criticism from Democrats, rights advocates, many students and educators. Meanwhile, the Idaho State House has passed a bill that would criminalize gender-affirming health care for trans children and teens. The bill makes it a felony punishable with life in prison for a doctor who provides gender-affirming care, including surgeries and hormone treatments. It would also make it a felony to make trans youth out of the state, to take trans youth out of the state to receive that care elsewhere. This all comes as a fight escalates in Texas over a directive by the Republican governor, Greg Abbott, that orders state welfare officials to launch child abuse investigations against parents who seek gender-affirming care for their trans children. We go now to Chase Strangio, Deputy Director for Trans Justice with the ACLU, LGBTQ and HIV Project, the ACLU part of a lawsuit to block the Texas directive. Chase, let's start with Florida and what happened there.
Thanks, Amy, and good morning. Yeah, so starting specifically with Florida, we now have this so-called Don't Say Gay bill that heads to Governor DeSantis's desk. He has indicated his support for the bill. I want to make two just quick points about this piece of legislation as it relates to the legislation and the national context. First, we're hearing a lot about from supporters about how this is really targeting young children in classrooms with an explicit prohibition in the K through 3 context. But as a parent of a fourth grader, what are families like mine supposed to do? What are kids like mine supposed to do? Those are grades where people are urged to talk about their families. So what this does is it erases the possibility that young people can speak about their own lives, their own truth. And that connects to this larger national context where what we're seeing is a national, well-funded effort to attack and eradicate trans youth and trans lives specifically. And that is not an effect of what we are seeing. That is the intention.
And can you talk a bit more about the context in which this and other bills are being advanced by Republican lawmakers, especially in the case in Florida, where DeSantis clearly is a potential presidential candidate?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing nationally is an effort to leverage and weaponize misinformation, particularly about trans people, to mobilize a political base in the lead up to 2022 and 2024. And this is happening in state houses across the country that are deeply gerrymandered, that have shifted incredibly far to the right as a result, in large part, of the Supreme Court's decision in 2013 to gut the Voting Rights Act with the Shelby County versus Holder decision. So we can't understand this national context without understanding the voter suppression that is happening, without understanding the efforts to restrict access to reproductive health care. There is a dynamic process that is mobilizing state control over people's bodies through voter suppression structures in order to make it harder for people to survive in the lead up to major national elections in 2022, the midterms, and then in 2024 with the presidential election. And that's what we're seeing from GOP leadership, not just in Florida, but also in places like South Dakota and Texas as well.
And Chase, you're an attorney in the case of Doe versus Abbott in Texas. Can you describe that case and what has happened so far?
Yeah, I think we really have to understand that there is an absolute crisis in Texas. Families are being terrorized by Governor Abbott's completely extra legal and impermissible directive to the Child Welfare Agency to start investigating families and threatening the general public with criminal prosecution if they do not report trans youth and their families to the Child Welfare Agencies. Right now on the ground, we know that families are being investigated solely because they have transgender children. Teachers are being asked to report transgender children and their families to child welfare authorities, and providers have cut off health care across the state. So the practical impact is catastrophic, and people are suffering. We filed a lawsuit to try to block this directive. We are currently in court, in state court in Austin, to try to stop the implementation of this directive at every level, and that litigation continues. But the reality is that this national conversation and the actions by, the Alabama legislature, the Florida legislature, and executive officials in Texas is having the effect of making it difficult, if not impossible, for trans young people to survive.
Texas, Chase, are they threatening to take trans children away from their parents?
They are threatening to take trans children away from their parents for the sole and exclusive purpose that their parents are loving and supporting them and providing them with medically necessary doctor-recommended health care. I cannot stress this enough. They are coming into homes, investigating families solely because parents love their kids and are providing care consistent with the recommendations of every major medical association in the United States.
And the significance of what happened on Friday, the Houston-based Texas Children's Hospital, the largest pediatric hospital in the country, announcing it's stopping prescribing gender-affirming hormone therapies?
They have cut off care, canceled appointments, and we're talking about life-saving, necessary care. So we have young people who are relying on this care to stabilize their health and well-being. A lot of this care is time-specific. So they are pulling young people off of care that's going to force them into their endogenous puberty. The extent of the fear and trauma is unimaginable right now, and there is very little recourse for many people. So we are fighting with everything we have to stop not only the implementation of these directives, but the fallout from them. Because it's not just these large hospitals, but individual providers, because fear of criminal prosecution if they continue to follow their ethical obligation as doctors to treat their patients.
And Chase, we only have about a minute left, but I'm wondering if you could talk about some of the legislation occurring in other states, for instance, in Idaho, Iowa, or Utah.
Yeah, I think I just want to highlight briefly that both Idaho and Alabama currently have felony bans on health care pending. So if those bills pass in Alabama, there's one vote left in the House. In Idaho, it has to make it to the Senate. These are bills that also would be similarly catastrophic for trans people. And we already have such a bill that thankfully we enjoined in Arkansas, but our litigation continues there. And of course, there's dozens of bills across the country still pending.
And specifically in Idaho, what you are most concerned about happening there?
You know, I'm concerned that this bill passes and all care is cut off. And not only is it cut off, that bill would make it a felony with potential life imprisonment, not only to treat people in state, but to take someone out of state to get the treatment. What are families supposed to do? And as a parent, I simply cannot imagine what it must feel like to face criminal prosecution to try to keep your kid alive.
And how many bills like this have been introduced around the country, Chase?
We are facing a context now where over 35 states have introduced bills targeting transgender young people. Thankfully, we are able to stop some of them, but we are continuing to fight to the very end of these legislative sessions because there is an aggressive push to move these quickly through state legislatures.
Well, we want to get into the details of these, so we're going to do part two of our discussion with you right now. Chase Strangio, Deputy Director for Trans Justice with the ACLU, LGBTQ, and HIV Project. That does it for our show, Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for Human Resources Manager. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Messiah Rhodes, Noreen Sheikh, Maria Terracena. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
You're listening to Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. And Grant, I bet you've been up to the same thing I have been up to, which is perusing seed catalogs and dreaming of this year's garden.
Yep. It's like the adult version of the Sears catalogs that you looked at Christmas time when you were a kid.
Isn't that the truth?
But they're so beautiful. All these lovely plants and flowers and... it's just delightful.
Well, yeah, the images, but of course also the language is what's catching my eye. You know, some of those names are just, I mean, why would they be naming fruits and vegetables things like diplomat or Albion or seascape, you know? I mean, they're sort of like paint chips or something.
Yeah. There's a sequence of three that I saw. It's Divino, Sabeto, Oroch. They're like some characters from the new, you know, the new Star Trek series.
Oh, I was thinking a law firm or something. I've had some fun fooling around with those names and just putting them together, just piling them together into little poems. How about this one? Purple Passion, Jersey Night, Silky Sweet Hybrid, Ruby Perfection.
Wow. That's prom night. With your sweetie playing Bruce Springsteen on the radio.
Actually, it's a poem about cabbage and asparagus.
Oh, yeah, that too. I do like a good cabbage. Asparagus not so much, but
right?
Cabbage I do. Yeah.
Here's another one. Sugar Baby, Starlight, Crimson Sweet Sparkle, Tasty Bites.
Wow. And that's first love, right? That's what
right?
I'm thinking here. This
right?
is your first love, a little, you know, shy hand holding, and then you both give a little your first smooch. Yeah,
yeah. Actually, it's about watermelon and strawberries. One more, German winter, white swan, night and day, purple ruffles,
flashback mix.
German opera. Has to be, right?
No, it's edible flowers.
No, either that or it's a Berlin nightclub at 3 a.m.
Could be.
But you plucked these names from where? From the seed catalog websites?
Right, from the Burpee and the Johnny Seeds catalogs. They're lots of fun.
Yeah, they are lots of fun. If you're planting your garden or going through the names and there's something that's really struck you, give us a call. Let us know what you think. Maybe put together your own seed poems, 877-929-9673, or send your seed poetry to words@waywardradio.org.
Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, this is Tenley Thompson calling from Jackson, Wyoming.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
It's a super fun town. We're just outside the national parks and up high sure. in the mountains, and it's kind of a outdoor wonderland for sure. So, all right, guys, I've got lots of friends, and I've been out here in a long time in the valley, and we have a lingo out here that's sometimes called bro bra. And it's what skiers and snowboarders and mountain bikers and other outdoor enthusiasts sometimes speak. And we say a lot of terms that some of which I grew up with and some which I've only heard relatively recently that I'm really curious about where they come from. And the one I'm most curious about is the term send it. So if a skier or a snowboarder takes a piece of really difficult terrain or if somebody's trying to challenge them to do it, they'll say, oh, bro, go send it. Send that cliff, or sick, you sent that man. And I'm wondering where